From the Spec Network, this is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to the show. Kaushik, we've had a show that's been requested for quite some time now.
Absolutely.
And, I know that you and I have talked. We did a Google I.O. recap. You know, previously we always did the kind of the Google I.O. show where one of us was at Google I.O. And this year we didn't do that. We did the recap, but we left something out. We left Jetpack Compose out of that picture and said, hey, we're going to do a follow-up episode. And today's that day where we're going to talk about Jetpack Compose. And you actually found someone pretty interesting to talk to. Who did you find?
This person who might know a thing or two about Jetpack Compose. We're happy to have Leland Richardson on the show. Leland is super interesting for so many other reasons. So because we had this opportunity, we'll definitely talk about Jetpack Compose, but I'd also love to like learn more from like Leland because he has a very interesting past, and that's something that I know both you and I are super interested in. So that's definitely something we will talk about. Without further ado, let's just hop right on. Welcome to the show, Leland.
Hey guys, thanks for having me. This is it's going to be fun.
Definitely, it's going to be very interesting. I just spent the last couple of days up in Toronto at the North American Regional GDE Summit, and when I was there, I actually hung out with one of your previous coworkers quite a bit, and that was Gabriel Peel, who's also been a previous guest on our show here. He had a ton of great things to say about you, said you were really intelligent, and one of the things that he really respected was your knowledge of kind of React. And so I'm kind of bring that up here, is that it seems that, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you're currently at Google, but you previously had a different world as kind of a React and JavaScript developer. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. Prior to Google, I was working at Airbnb on our native infrastructure team, so had some exposure to iOS and Android, but kind of my main area of expertise was around React and kind of the web development world, where I had spent most of the kind of preceding 5 years or so really kind of embedded in that world. So it's kind of interesting now to be at Google working on Android, and it's kind of exciting to be part of a new community and learning a bunch of new stuff.
It's fascinating. I remember when you sent us your Twitter handle, I was like, why does that sound so familiar? And your handle, Intelligible Babble, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to pronounce, but I was like, why does that sound so familiar? And I looked at my RSS feed, and that's when I remembered you had written a whole bunch of stuff on functional JavaScript too, right? You had like a blog post series, and I was like, I remember running into that, which is why it was so familiar. And it's funny how full circle around, yeah, I see you now in the Android world. So it's very encouraging.
Yeah, it's I don't know. I'm sort of the kind of blogger that sort of thinks they're going to write blogs every week and then ends up writing one every 5 years or something. So,
isn't that like all bloggers except
right,
Don?
Yeah.
Don's the only one who's good and has been like very...
I don't know about that.
He's been like encouraging and telling me like, no, you got to get on this. I'm just, yeah, I think that's all bloggers. I look at Don, I get inspired. I sit in front of the computer, then I open YouTube.
So Leland, I would really love to kind of dive into like, you're now at Google, you're now working on Jetpack. So something happened from you working on React and then moving into Android that I'd like to dig into eventually. But I kind of want to get your ideas or your thoughts on what attracted you to React, and then how did you get into that world and what kind of led you in there and kind of, kept you there for a while?
Yeah. Gosh, I was a very early adopter of React when they announced it, and I'm not sure how much you guys know about this, but when React was first announced, it, it wasn't actually warmly received. It was kind of a controversial framework. And I, at the time, I was, I kind of had my own startup and was, you know, it was a small startup. I was writing a lot of code, and it seemed interesting to me, and like just weird enough that I like kind of wanted to stop what I was doing and play around with it. And I think a lot of the things that it was trying to do and the problems it was trying to solve really resonated with me. And it, you know, it's changed a lot since then, but I was kind of a converted user pretty quickly, and just found it was something that, like, I guess the word I like to use is delightful. You know, it was kind of a delightful thing to program UIs in, and I don't know, kind of ever since it's been something that I've, you know, thought a lot about, and you know, I was kind of fortunate enough to be able to kind of become friends with a lot of the people that worked on React, and kind of got to be a part of that community in a big way, and have, you know, kind of been in love with it ever since.
And to be clear, this is like React as in like the web React framework, right? Not React Native necessarily.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, they're sort of coupled communities, but but yeah, I mean, React Native came several years later, and I was also a fairly early adopter of React Native, although just sort of on personal projects, and was kind of really intrigued by the architectural model of React Native and what that could mean, and was part of the React Native core team early on, and kind of like to see myself as like someone who just tried to build the like something in React Native that seemed difficult, and see how like what I would consider the right way to do that, and then try to kind of inform the community about, you know, how I did that, and you know, what ways React Native might need to kind of change in order to do that better and stuff like that.
When you got into React, I mean, you had already been doing web development, it seems, for a while. What would you say from a developer perspective, you know, because we are a developer-focused show here, what were some of the things that really, I mean, you said delightful, so it means like it must have solved some problems in a way that made you happy. And if you could like illustrate that, what were some of those things that kind of brought you that happiness, if you could explain it to the users who maybe who haven't dealt with React or anything like that before?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting, actually. I think a lot of the sort of current practices, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but like a lot of the kind of current architecture of Android from a UI perspective reminds me a lot of what the web felt like before I started using React.
Yes. And preaching the good sermon there.
Yes.
Oh, preach it. And so I don't know. I mean, I remember this kind of time where, you know, at the time jQuery was very popular, which I think is ubiquitous enough that probably most people kind of know what it is. But if you don't know what it is, it was kind of a utility library to kind of paper over a lot of the design inconsistencies of browser APIs, and it was kind of what everyone used, but it didn't really help you architect anything. It really just was kind of a way to you know, manipulate raw DOM nodes, and a lot of web development at the time, I think, kind of preached this idea of, you know, separation of concerns, which, you know, which we all kind of, I still think is a very important principle. I just think it's often misunderstood. and, you know, there was this you know, you'd throw things into a template, and that would kind of define how the structure of UI, your UI might start off. And then once your application kind of started, you would write a lot of code that would go kind of through that structure, find a piece of it, and maybe change it or update it as state in your application changed. And this type of programming was very, very brittle. And so, I mean, I think in the Android world, if anytime you use find view by ID, you're pretty much falling into this this area. And there's a lot of problems with that, especially as your UI gets more and more complex. I think it works great for fairly static UIs, just because they're kind of simple enough that you can get away with getting most of the important bits into your layout XML or your HTML or whatever that part of the UI is. But as things get more and more complex and dynamic, you start to kind of manipulate the tree that's in memory enough to where all of a sudden you have to kind of keep in your head what the current state of the tree is, because it's so different from how it started out. And you have to make sure that you kind of have all of these things dealt with. And even more than just the cognitive overhead of doing that in a very dynamic UI, it's just I think it's an artificial form of separation. Like the whole idea of separation of concerns, it's kind of this artificial thing where you think that because one thing is in XML and another thing is in Java or Kotlin, that they're somehow separated. But in fact, there's a very large amount of implicit coupling going on. And that coupling, I think, is actually much more dangerous than an explicit coupling, where you had this feeling that the two were separate, but they actually weren't. And so actually making them the same thing, where you might even unify the language, and that's kind of what Compose and React and all these things do, is they allow you to use a fully fledged programming language to start to find some of these UIs, and that gives you a much more mature tool set to refactor things and start to build abstractions that actually do form a real separation of concerns, where you can kind of use all the same tools that you would use in any other part of the stack to accomplish that.
I just love two points. I want to call out two points that you brought out. One is, I never realized the analogy with jQuery. I've used jQuery in the past too, right? And jQuery is just, I love jQuery. I still do. But like you said, it is probably just a DOM manipulation utility, right? They just made manipulating the DOM really easy, and that's just enabled this world. I love that you called that analogy to find view by ID, because in some ways it pretty much is that. It is like the Android DOM is basically the view hierarchy, right? And then you're basically just drawing that out and then setting state on the views. So I love that analogy. That's one thing I want to call out. The other is the point you mentioned about separation of concerns. My quick follow-up was, well, can you explain how you think it's being misunderstood? And I think you hit that really on the point as well. Just because you have them in different formats, like XML and, you know, a Java file, or in the JavaScript world, or in the React, not the React, in the jQuery world, just because you have them in different formats, that doesn't necessarily mean they're not the same concern, right? And vice versa too, right? Just because I think people sometimes everyone likes the idea of separation of concerns, but that doesn't just separation in itself is sometimes confused as being separation of concerns. But really it's that latter part, that concern part, where it's the view being manipulated, the view state. I think that's the part that's really, unless you take some time to understand the framework, it's really tricky to clearly identify that abstraction. So thank you for calling that out, because I think that's also pretty valuable.
Yeah, and I think really what happens is, when you have this separation of format, if you will, the result is that any coupling that you do have is sort of forced into being an implicit coupling, and that is far worse than explicit, I think, in most cases, and so I think what Compose does in a big way is turns all of that coupling into an explicit coupling, and then provides tools and patterns to actually factor your code much much better, I think. And that's sort of where the component model of Compose and React and all that stuff kind of comes into play. And I think it ends up being a really nice way to factor code.
So that brings up, I mean, that's a perfect time to ask this question of like, what is Jetpack Compose? There's going to be a lot of people listening to this show that have zero clue what Jetpack Compose is. They have zero experience with React and any of that kind of, you know, paradigm. What's the best way to explain what Jetpack Compose is to those folks?
Yeah, great question. So Jetpack Compose at its core is we should probably separate Jetpack Compose into two parts.
Okay.
And one is what I would call the runtime, which is what I work on specifically. And part of the runtime, I guess, is the compiler that goes along with it. And we'll probably talk more about that later. But you can think of the runtime as the thing that sort of dictates the programming model. And then there's what I'll call Compose UI, which is basically a new toolkit, a new UI toolkit that the Android team is building. And we're building it on top of Jetpack Compose. So it's sort of built where this new programming model, this new paradigm, is kind of a first-class target of this UI toolkit. And so I'm going to kind of separate those for the moment. And so if we kind of look at the runtime and the programming model, which is the most direct kind of comparison to what React is in the JavaScript world.
I was going to follow up with that. Could you like maybe give us the analogy? Because I think when most people think about Jetpack Compose, like they think about like they've seen the demos that you and like Romain Gay and a bunch of others like have given. So I think maybe they're thinking about the UI toolkit. Can you like maybe I'll spend some time on like the runtime? Because my follow-up question was, well, just like in the JavaScript world, we realized jQuery is like a DOM manipulation mechanism, and then React came out of it, but we didn't fundamentally change necessarily. It was more like a library that helped organize this, right? Why do you think Jetpack Compose needed to exist now to like reorient ourselves and like rethink this whole thing, right? As against like using the existing Android architecture, the compiler, and sort of, you know, adding libraries to just like manipulate it. And it seems like you've made this distinction already about the runtime and the Compose UI, right? Could just having the Compose UI toolkit not have enabled that? Like, why did we even need to like make such a fundamental change into the Android architecture? Does that make sense?
I think so. I think there is sort of, I think maybe you're flipping them around. I'm not sure. But I would view the UI toolkit is kind of built on top of this paradigm in a pretty fundamental way. And I think there's maybe this question that you're getting at, which is like, why now? Like, why are we doing this now? Why do we think this is important for the Android community? And why do we think we needed this whole sort of paradigm shift in how we build UI? Which I think is an interesting question. So I can kind of try and give an answer to that. I think there are several reasons, and you might get different answers from different people. But I think one, there was a motivation to pull the UI toolkit out of AOSP, out of the platform. So unbundle it from the OS, which allows us, like the UI toolkit team, to iterate on the UI toolkit and build new features and fix bugs and things like that out of band from OS updates. We kind of are in the situation where we can deliver something new and awesome, and then a bunch of people in the community are like, okay, great. I'll use that in 5 years whenever you know, I can.
Right.
And that's kind of frustrating, but also, you know, the OEMs and stuff are kind of able to modify the UI toolkit kind of as they see fit for their like system UI and stuff, which may in turn create hard to reproduce, you know, bugs that are hard for us to kind of deal with. And so this solves that as well. And it allows
Samsung.
So anyway, I think there was a strong motivation to move the toolkit out. And then when you're doing that, there's sort of 10 plus years of learning, you know, that we've had and sort of API regret that we've had since doing that. And so there are a lot of things that I think we wanted to change. And at the same time, we were kind of working on what a declarative, I'm going to call it a declarative programming model for the UI, although we can get into the meaning of that term later. But we were kind of working on what this would look like in the Android world. And so those sort of two ideas started to become one. And we realized that kind of everyone agreed that if we were to build a new UI toolkit, that this is kind of what it ought to look like, and sort of the programming model that would be fitting of it. The other thing is, I think that we've, and so this speaks more to the programming model, is I think the demand, like the industry demand on what a UI should look like, has become way more complicated in the past, you know, well, in the past 10 years since we came out. And so UIs are much more dynamic. There's much more, you know, animation and fluidity. And that kind of goes back to the parts I was talking about, where this implicit coupling ends up actually being a real problem. And what we found is, you know, other communities have started to, like the web community, have started to adopt this programming model, and with overwhelming success. You know, I think React kind of pioneered this model in the web community, but pretty much every other framework that exists today in the web has sort of followed suit in a way, and has a similar component based model and sort of pseudo declarative programming model that basically users have kind of come to demand. And you know, we've seen a lot of these ideas kind of bleed over into the mobile space in both iOS and Android. You know, there have kind of been frameworks like Litho and ComponentKit that like Facebook has come out with. Airbnb, you know, built Epoxy. There's a lot of new interest in, like, you know, MVI type patterns and stuff like this that is all, I think, kind of a result of this revolution in UI development that we're kind of seeing across the whole industry. And you know, we can see, like, Apple just came out with Swift UI, which was a, you know, real strong shift in this direction. And I think that it's pretty clear in a few years, I don't think anyone's going to be building UI in any other way.
Yeah, it's interesting because you mentioned a lot of these points, and the unbundling part, I also wanted to call out Apple, like, obviously with Swift UI, I've also gone so strongly in this direction. The only difference is I'm just fascinated by the way that the Android team was able to pull this out and, like, unbundle it, right? Like, you don't realize how strong a value it is unless you've seen some level of, like, fragmentation in the past, which as Android developers we have. But now, like, having it unbundled is just, it's, I don't know, it's a feat of engineering. Just thinking about, like, the little that I know about how the Android architecture works, is I'm surprised you were able to pull it off, and I'm extremely, extremely grateful that you did, because without that it would just be like a non-starter, right? Like, I was like, talk to me in 5 years and then, you know, I can think about changing the way I build my UI. Whereas now I'm keenly interested and aware right now with how Jetpack Compose is evolving, because I know the minute it's out, I can just add a dependency in my library and I'm ready to go, right? Versus our friends at like in iOS land, they, I mean, because I've talked to a lot of my colleagues who are like iOS developers, and they're like super excited about Swift UI, but they've never been bitten by this this kind of thing where you're like, well, you got to kind of wait for a few years before you can actually start to use it, because only then will it trickle down to the devices that are being used by 90% of, like, you know, the users.
Yeah, although I mean, it still exists in iOS land as well. I mean, their adoption mm-hmm. curve is much sharper than on Android, but it still mm-hmm. exists. And you know, you have to, especially for something like this, when you're talking about kind of system APIs that you can have sort of a graceful fallback to some other behavior like that, that you can kind of add on the moment it comes out. But something like a UI framework, mm-hmm. it's really not mm-hmm. a thing where you can gracefully fall back to anything, unless you want to write all of your UI twice, which you know, I think most people will not do. And so right. I think that they feel that they will be feeling this pain as well. But it's more than that. I think it's the it's really the speed of iteration and progress. I think that's going to be most important, is that this allows us the ability to actually make really important breaking changes when necessary, and kind of propel the community forward without burning all of our users as a result. You know, a breaking change you know, might prevent you from upgrading, but also, you know, you can upgrade on your own time. And it'll allow us to, I think, really propel the framework forward as time goes on.
So I hear a lot of the benefits here of why we'd want to use it, you know, from, you know, being able to update some of the additional engineering benefits of it and so forth. But if I actually want to start using Jetpack Compose, what would I need to do to start getting set up? Or what would maybe, if I wanted to create a simple view in Jetpack Compose, what would that look like from a developer perspective?
Do you mean like right now or when we're sort of ready?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. Like, I don't know when you and your team are going to be ready. And I think it's hard to predict the future of like, all right, well, here's what it's going to look like at the end. Or do you have a solid understanding of here's what it's going to look like at the end, and we're just working towards the end result?
Right now we're sort of, it's still in the phase where we're making some pretty big changes to how it will look, like pretty broad sweeping changes to public facing APIs. So that's something we're still figuring out. And as a result, like basically right now, if you want to use it, it's possible to play around with it, but we've very intentionally tried to make it something that you'd have to be an insane person to you know, actually ship an app with this, because we've really kind of tried to lock it down in that way, just because we know that as soon as we actually publish a Maven artifact or anything like that, that someone's going to start shipping apps. And then, you know, even if it, like, basically we'll be forced to say, you know, I told you so when we break everyone and change things. And so we want to get to the point where there's some reasonable kind of sense of consistency, even if we're still in an alpha state where we reserve the right to, you know, make breaking changes that like it actually is something that looks reasonably close to what the end state might be.
So now that makes complete sense of why we'd want to do that. But I'm also looking at some slides, which we'll provide the link for in the show notes. So if you're in your podcast app or online, take a look at the show notes. You could see the slides that of a talk that you gave recently at, I think it was Chain React Conf. And it was called React Meet Compose. And there's a bunch of code samples inside of there. And I was wondering if you could just kind of walk us through kind of like a simple example, at least just so the listeners can kind of wrap their head around like what this looks like from a perspective of like, okay, maybe let's assume you've published this to a Maven repository and I want to start using this. What would that kind of look like? And again, we know this is not public yet, but or available. But what does that look like if I want to create just a simple, you know, a view on the screen with a text view and a button that updates the view or updates the text view? I know it's, for me looking at the code, it's completely different than how I've done it traditionally in Android. And I was wondering if you could kind of explain that for the listeners so they can kind of wrap their head around what these changes are, what that looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. So Jetpack Compose at its sort of core, the core building block of Compose is Kotlin functions. And we actually have sort of created a new type of function that we call a composable function. And when I say new type of function, you can kind of think of it as how suspend is kind of a new type of function in Kotlin. And so this is sort of similar in that it kind of has the same feeling as any other plain function that you'd be writing in Kotlin, except it has sort of some new special powers. And so we call these composable functions. And a composable function you can think of as mapping very closely to what in React is a component. But so this is the kind of fundamental building block. And in that function, you can call other composable functions. And the kind of way to think about it is that the execution of your function is sort of describing what you want your UI to look like. So if you want your app to have two buttons kind of oriented vertically, then you might use what we call a column, which is a composable function. And then you would basically use Kotlin's trailing lambda syntax, which a lot of Kotlin DSLs use, and we're no exception, where you would basically say column and then curly brace, and that would kind of create this sense of nesting or hierarchy that that you can get inside here. And then inside of the body, if you will, of column, you would call button, and you might call it twice if you have two buttons, and then you'd pass in as parameters to those functions any sort of configuration information around the button. And so that kind of gives you an idea of like how you would sort of define a static UI, right? And you can see this mapping kind of one-to-one with XML or like a layout XML, where instead of defining XML tags, you're just creating function calls. And that's
so I don't,
just
so a, I don't have, is there no more XML view at all?
If you're writing an application using Jetpack Compose, you mm-hmm. will very likely not be writing any more view like layouts in XML.
Okay. Oh, okay. So basically you're writing it all in the code, like you're saying here with these, you know, these new Kotlin style functions. I'm kind of like just creating this, you know, like you said, I'm kind of composing a UI inside of the code. Is that a right assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. And so there is kind of this one-to-one mapping when your UI is static between layout XML and Compose. And you can think mm-hmm. of the function really as like a sort of like a template function. We like to think of it as a transform function from data into something, you know, a UI or a tree of some sort. But what gets interesting is that function now... the way you kind of want to write that function is as if it can be called kind of at any time. And whenever it gets called, essentially the sort of data that you might use to determine what the current state of your UI looks like, you should try to think of those as parameters to that function. And so you kind of get the current state of the UI in as parameters. And then you just run the code that describes how you want your UI to look at that point in time. And this includes...
So just if I'm... just a quick... Yeah, I just want to quickly understand if I'm understanding what you're saying is right. So typically the way I would do it is like I would have like my activity in a view model. And from my view model, based on some business logic that I have, I would say show one button or like two buttons, like you said, in a column. So that information is going to be sent down from my view model. And that's the state that you're talking about. That view state is what you're talking about that will be sent as a parameter to this composable function?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Okay, got it.
Right, and so now at this point, if your UI kind of changes over time, you can just use normal language level primitives to kind of change how the UI looks. So if you have a list of users and you want to and you want to render like a a profile photo for each one, you can just loop over the users, using a for loop or a for each or whatever kind of mechanism you want. You can even have, reactive streams or anything. And so then you just kind of loop over that, and that allows you to kind of in a very intuitive and familiar way construct a UI. And then, kind of doing that in a very naive way might be really, really non-performant. But you can kind of just rely on the Compose framework to sort of do the right thing and only update what's changed and things like that.
I'm looking at one of your examples in your slides here, and I think it's a very simple example, and I like the way it is. It shows like a function, and then inside of there, there's actually some code that performs a conditional check. Hey, if we get some data from some endpoint or whatever, and if that data is null, then we're going to perhaps show a loading screen. Otherwise, we want to show the header, which is another function, and we want to show the body, which is another function. It seems like it's very easy to read. Like, I can tell very easily what's going on inside of this function.
Yeah, exactly.
I had a quick follow-up with these composable functions that you mentioned, right? And maybe I might be like diving into some of the details here. So if you still wanted to like step back and like walk us through that process, that's fine. But you mentioned like you have this column and you have like these special functions, and then you have like a button component that you would write. Would the expectation then be that I would write in the same vein as I write custom views today in Android? Is this something that would be expected? Would you be, if I had like, say a custom kind of thing where I have like two vertical components, one bigger than the other, I'm just giving an example, right? Is this, if it's a little different from the native components that you typically see on Android, is that something that I would be expected to write? That was like the first part of my question. And the second is like, yeah, how would I deal with things that are very custom, right? Like I have this this timer view that has like all kinds of funky things happening with animations that needs to be driven. But if I wanted to do that in Jetpack Compose, how would I kind of do that? So it's more like, how do I do like the custom aspects of these components in Jetpack Compose?
Yeah, it's a great question. One of the, primary goals of Jetpack Compose is to make that type of custom creation much, much easier. And this really, like the programming model really lends itself well to this. Like basically, you can think of writing a custom view in this world as equivalent to writing a function in like the current world. Like right now, when something gets complicated, like when code gets complicated, kind of the first thing that we do is we try to factor it out into separate functions potentially and kind of build the lines of abstraction along those lines. And that's like a very natural thing. That's not like a, language or technology specific. That's kind of what everyone does in every programming language and every community. It's sort of,
and it like works pretty well,
hard,
right?
Yeah. And like functions are kind of really solid building blocks like that. That's kind of been shown already. And so you can think of what we're doing as just kind of going back to the roots and saying, here, we're giving you the power to create your own abstractions. And custom views are just that. And one of the cool things is that, like, one, because we're open source, and two, because the entire UI toolkit is built on top of Compose from the ground up, it allows you to see exactly how like we built these things and like kind of build your own in custom ways. And we've kind of built all of these primitive building blocks up to the kind of top level components that you might want. So right now we're building material, right? Like we're building a huge widget set for the material design spec. And all of those are just composable functions, and they're entirely built on top of public API. So all of material will be implemented in user land, basically. And you can, like, it allows us to kind of have a something that is material specific be sort of enforced as material, but it allows you to see that, like, okay, this is how material did it, and I want to do it a little bit different. Let me just, you know, copy that into my own composable function and do something kind of similar, but I'll add this and that there, and just sort of do that. And that that we think is sort of a much healthier kind of way to iterate on things. It removes sort of the presence of these, I'm not sure I like the word, but like these like God components that are configurable in every possible way, and are many thousands of lines long and things like that. And you'll see that a lot of the material components that are that we're building that are quite complex are actually just like 10 lines of code, because they're built on top of other like abstractions that are themselves 10 lines of code, which are built on top of other abstractions, which are themselves, you know, 10 lines of code. And so these things kind of build up and compose, you know, very well together. And the goal is for users to kind of have the same ability, where it's not like right now to make a custom view on Android is like considered a, you know, kind of a hard thing to do, right?
It's like you need to be like a wizard of black magic,
yeah,
it's like with deep knowledge of how the UI works,
right,
to do it well, you know,
yeah,
on draw, on measure, but you know, it,
yeah. And instead, in this world, we think it's one of the very first things to do. I mean, that's going to be step two of the Hello World tutorial, instead of being something that only very senior engineers do, and so it really changes the way of thinking, I think.
I love all of those things that you've mentioned. Because we just hit that topic, I just had a quick follow-up question. So you mentioned Jetpack Compose is being developed in the open, right? And a lot of these components, we can see how they're built. This means that it's all like open source. Can you also like tell, like, what exactly does that mean that Jetpack Compose is being built in the open?
Sure. Yeah. So right now, Jetpack Compose is being built as part of AOSP. It's part of the Android X repository. So it is considered a Jetpack library, as the name suggests, just like anything else. Mm-hmm. And you know, we've already accepted a handful of public contributions. I think it will get easier to contribute over time. Right now, I think quite difficult, due to a number of factors.
Not very forgiving, yeah, with the weights.
Well, and even beyond AOSP, just the, you know, we are intentionally very light on documentation right now, and a lot of the sort of core architecture of Compose is still being kind of built out, and that makes contributing very difficult when so many of these things are kind of in flight and really just being built for the first time. And there's a lot of pieces of it that are kind of left unimplemented because, you know, we're going to get to it next month or something. And I think it's just very difficult to contribute to right now. But I sincerely hope that once we're in a later stage, that it will be a much easier project to contribute to, and that people will be interested enough to do so.
Now, you had mentioned that we have, you know, you're working on the material components, which is awesome to hear. I mean, it actually reminds me very much of like the Flutter style. I mean, they'll look different, of course, but how Flutter has their own material components, and that was just nice to use right out of the box. But what got me thinking though is like, okay, Your example of you have maybe a list of users and you can loop over them. And of course, maybe that may not be the most performant way to do things. And so the first thing as an Android developer that popped into my head was, all right, well, what about existing things like a recycler view or anything else out there, constraint layout? Are there any, are those being kind of brought over or can I work with those? Or is there a new paradigm I need to adopt in regards to the existing views and stuff?
Yeah, so there's sort of two answers to that question, and both are sort of yes. But so one thing that has like maybe a lot of people miss, and we haven't really mentioned it so far in this talk, is that Compose, the runtime is independent of what type of UI you're building, and so you can actually use Compose to build like normal Android view trees. And so you can construct and manage views inside of Compose just as easily as you would kind of anything else. And so that means that technically something like recycler view, like I could sort of say just works. It sort of just works out of the box because views work out of the box. But the more complicated answer is that interleaving like the trees that Compose UI builds, which are not views, they're what we call component nodes. Interleaving those trees and view trees may not be the best thing. We're hoping that it's like reasonably performant and things like that, but what we really want people to move to long term is entire hierarchies that are sort of component nodes, and okay. And so if you wanted to do that, like then recycler view is obviously a view, and so wouldn't sort of work that way. And so a lot of these things, recycler view included, we're kind of rebuilding in Compose UI building blocks themselves, and so there will be a Compose UI specific implementation of recycler view that will reuse a lot of the same code. A lot of it is independent of the actual tree and everything, but like a lot of recycler views logic is really about other things like scheduling and stuff like that. So there you kind of have two options there, and there will be some views that that we probably won't re-implement in Compose UI. One example is web view is probably not going to get rewritten.
No. That'd be a beast.
Yeah. And also like map view probably not going to be rewritten for a long time, and ad view probably not going to be rewritten, like all those things. And that's why the kind of interleaving between the two types of trees is really important to us, is because it like people will just need to do this from time to time. There are certain things that we think the right kind of next step is to rewrite them, and recycler view is one of those things.
So does that mean like, and I think you may have answered this, but I want some clarification, that if I want to use a map view or add view or whatever I want to use that you're not converting over to Compose, I can still call that from within my Compose view? There's still a way to do that?
Yeah. And it'll actually feel very, very sort of natural and first class. It basically inside of this is maybe a little bit weird actually, but inside of a composable function, views end up looking like composables themselves. So you can just call them like any other composable function. Essentially the properties of views become parameters to that like composable function. And so it ends up kind of feeling pretty natural. Like if you have a column component in Compose UI, you could just change column to linear layout and it would kind of just work. but
if the properties match, basically,
right,
that's crazy. And is what enabled this today mostly around like the Kotlin DSL? Because I'm trying to think how I would even like go about implementing something like this. And it seems like you probably have to like leverage a lot of like what Kotlin provides with that, right? Was that how you pulled it off? Like, or is there like some secret inside baseball to like enable something like that?
Yeah, it's actually quite a bit more complicated than that. This is where a lot of the compiler magic comes in. What we're doing is we're actually in part of our compiler plugin is sort of participating in the type resolution stage of the Kotlin compiler, and so we're basically intercepting calls to things like views inside of these functions and providing a different meaning for that. Which is a fairly invasive thing to do. And so, you know, we're trying to do so in a very defined way and in a way that has kind of a rhyme and reason to it is sort of hard to mess up and doesn't have these sort of dangerous ambiguities and things like that. But that is kind of one of the weirder things that we're doing inside of the compiler. Yeah.
Now I want to ask the million-dollar question. And this is all in code here. And so as everyone who listens to the show knows, Kaushik and I love testing. What does a testing story around Jetpack Compose look like?
Yeah, it's a great question and definitely one that's been asked many times. It's very important to people, and we know that. And testing was something that we actually paid a lot of attention to from the very beginning. And you know, we've been working with a lot of people, like the Espresso team and stuff, to make sure that we end up with a solid answer here. But I'm actually really excited for what this is gonna end up looking like. But basically there will be ways to in a test environment sort of kick off what we call a composition, which is like, you know, the building of a UI, and then it will be easy for you to make assertions on the resulting hierarchy. And there kind of be a couple modes of testing that I'm not really going to get into because I don't think those things are sort of stable concepts yet. But one of the things that we really, really wanted to do is make it so that you could run these tests essentially without an emulator. I mean, I know that from my experience, this is of one of the infrastructure needed to run tests for mobile devices.
Hallelujah.
It's extremely painful. It's one of the reasons that that we really wanted to kind of start decoupling things and stuff like that, and we're seeing we're very close to seeing that come to light, where we're able to kind of run the full UI tests and what we call like host side testing, so on a desktop environment.
That's fantastic.
And we're pretty excited for that just because it just makes things so much easier.
This is just, this is like music to my ears. I've always, because these days I have like a MacBook 13 inch, and like sometimes I don't want to spin up an emulator as I'm like in the BART or I'm like commuting. And I just like always wish, I was like, I'm not like doing anything crazy with my UI. And this is exactly the kind of thing I would have loved to have, right? Just test that my hierarchy is like in this specific manner. That's all I care about. You shouldn't have to spin up like an emulator and then have my battery basically drain in the background, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's still important to run actual tests on emulators to get, you know, the environment
UI that you,
right. But I mean, it's still very possible to get a lot of information out of just running on the desktop in the host side environment and exercising the code that you're writing, and it's just as useful.
That makes perfect sense. One question, and actually I had two questions. Let me first, I want to dive in a little deeper. I don't exactly know how you would give an answer for this per se, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If I think as one thing I've always found very useful in the way I've like developed and programmed stuff is if I know exactly how things are working under the hood, right from the point of the API, right? With Jetpack Compose, could you maybe give us like a bird's eye view? And what I'm thinking is, I was like, okay, you mentioned this thing, right? You have this composable function called column, and then you slap two buttons. How does that land up looking, not necessarily in the bytecode, but like what lands up happening in the end, right? Like how does the Android system see this? Like what does that bytecode look like in like relation to how we have it rendered today? Because if you talk about how it works today, I think I have a sense, right? Like with Vue, I have like my Java class, they're compiled down, I have onMer. Like, can you give the equivalent or at least connect it to the point of how the Android system works? Does that make sense? I basically I'm looking for like, okay, I slap this compose function. What happens right after that under the hood, right? Does the UI toolkit or the runtime like see that? Does it compile it down to Kotlin? Then from Kotlin, does it get compiled down to class files? I'm just like trying to understand, how does this compose thing even like work, right? So just to get a sense or feel of that.
Yeah. And I think if people are really interested in this, the probably two best resources right now are, I wrote a blog post on this called Compose from First Principles.
First Principles.
Mm-hmm. And that post kind of tries to give a, like, sort of built up from just normal Kotlin, what it is that we're doing. And it's not, you know, exactly what we're doing, but I think it provides a fairly solid mental model. And then the other thing, is what Don mentioned, was the slides from the recent talk I gave, React Meet Compose. In that talk, there's some more kind of advanced things that we're doing specifically with our compiler, that kind of might explain some of the magic, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, I think the, if I'm to, you know, sort of just give a quick bird's eye view, like you said, is Compose is really built to efficiently maintain and update a tree, like a tree of some type. And you can think of, just since it's familiar to people, let's just consider views in this case. And so views form a tree. You know, you have view groups and views. And what Compose does is sort of take a function and allows you to kind of have that DSL-like structure, where that the structure of the like code that you run sort of maps to the structure of the resulting hierarchy that you're building. And so you can think of calling these functions as building up that hierarchy. And so the nesting that you would get from these like lambdas in the Kotlin DSL sort of translate to diving down a level in the tree and adding children to that node instead of the parent one and things like that. And so you can think of Compose and the runtime machinery as something that is sort of abstracting that like the necessary threading around of nodes and construction of them and stuff like that is sort of trying to abstract that away from you so that you can just describe what the UI looks like. And I think kind of the really important bit is like, because it's not just a way to build hierarchies, it's also a way to update them. And so the other thing that Compose does, which is really sort of novel, is it allows you to kind of restart that building of the hierarchy kind of at any point in the hierarchy, which is why you need to write these composable functions as if they could sort of be called at any time with any different inputs and things like that. And so a lot of Compose's machinery is sort of around how to do those restarts efficiently and like how to, instead of recreating the hierarchy every time, how to just change the things that have changed. In
the diffing mechanisms, basically, right?
Right.
Which is where like the whole reactive stuff comes, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know.
Perfect.
That's,
yeah.
That's my bird's eye view, I guess.
No, that was great. Yeah, this makes a lot of sense. And I'll also make sure that we add Compose from First Principles, your blog post from Intelligible Babel. I think I got it right this time. we'll make sure to add that in the show notes. So if folks are like really curious, that's pretty well. Yeah, you've gone into like a lot of detail. So that blog post, I think, would be super helpful for that. The other like question I had, a large part of how this is being thought of, it seems like this is something that can translate to multiple platforms, not just Android, right? Is this something that's like in like this? Is this, yeah, hey, can you talk about that? Like, is this something you see like maybe us using like at one day, like for the web world, like shared cross platform? Like, is there any thoughts around this, or right now is it just let's deal with Android for now and then see if we can deal with this stuff at a future point?
Yeah, I mean, right now the Android team is really just focused on the Android platform, and that's sort of, you know, a priority. I think it is interesting to think about. I mean, Kotlin has a really interesting opportunity with Kotlin Native and you know, the ability to target even JavaScript as a compilation target. You know, I'm kind of hoping that, you know, someone you know, plays around with that or you know, really tries to push the needle, like when we're at that stage. But right now, you know, our primary focus is really just getting something that people can actually use, that isn't in this weird pre-alpha state and stuff like that. So
that makes sense. So the gears and piping exist. It's just that's not something that's going to be built at the moment, but yeah, for bold adventurers in the open source or programming land, they can, yeah, that's something to consider.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can see like React kind of went down a similar path as the, you know, the DOM was the primary target at first. And it was only later, you know, where, you know, people tried to understand, okay, like, you know, what else can we do with this? And, you know, right now Compose has been built in a way that's pretty agnostic, like agnostic to what type of tree you're building and stuff like that, because we actually had to already target two types of trees and all that. So, you know, I think the definitely, you know, the pieces are there and stuff, but yeah,
that makes sense. The last question I had was, at least from my side, was a very generic question. There are like a lot of other frameworks out there, right? There's obviously Flutter is the one that people most commonly think of. React is one. React Native, Swift UI. I know, I guess Jetpack Compose predated some of this stuff, but how do you, like, given that it is in such a malleable form, as developers of the API, how do you go about thinking what should go into the API or how an API should be, right? Like, can you talk about like how you think of how you approach that? You're like, oh, this part looks interesting, so let's try that. You're like, oh, this doesn't work. Can you talk about how some of that stuff works? Like, in the end, how are things built underneath? You know, how is the sausage made?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I'm not sure I have a great answer here. But there, you know, I think there's like my sort of litmus test, I guess, if you will, is like how much would I want to build a UI in this thing? And it's really hard to tell when you're building something new like this and it's like unfinished and all that. Like, it's hard to tell in just a few lines of code how much you like it or dislike it. Because a lot of times you end up picking out the real, I don't know, kind of like the things that become clear in those few lines but aren't actually that important. And it's not until you write, you know, hundreds of thousands of lines or millions of lines that the true issues start to emerge. And that's kind of the I hope that we get to, you know, before going 1.0 or anything, I hope that there's many millions of lines of code of Compose UI that's been written, so that we kind of have a good sense of this. But, you know, right now we can learn a lot from other people, from other patterns that have emerged in other communities, and also just kind of learn from our 10 years of experience building the Android UI system. But there is like enough different that, you know, we have to consider new things and maybe be a little bit adventurous in some areas. And I think one of the sort of the hardest thing for even for me, someone, you know, very familiar with this type of programming model, is to kind of understand, like, for a given proposed API, is it different or worse than if it's different than like what I'm used to, that might mean that it's better, but it just takes me some getting used to. But it also might mean that it's worse. And sometimes different and bad feel like the same thing.
Right.
And it's really, really hard to differentiate those. And so that's sort of my challenge, is knowing when we have something that's different and better instead of different and worse.
That's very insightful, and definitely something I guess you would expect an API developer to say, right? Like, and I like the idea you said about the many millions of lines of code that you need to write. Because that is the thing. It's hard to have a good, solid opinion about something until you've used it in different use cases, I imagine, right? It's hard to say just from like a Hello World demo if you like something or not. You know, you have to use it. You have to like take it through the hoops and like the dry runs, and then eventually you form an opinion. And I think the Android community is in safe hands because they have people like you and the Jetpack Compose team working on this. So we trust you on the APIs.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of another difficult part is, you know, I think that there's real value to providing something that's familiar to people and familiar to the Android ecosystem. But we have to balance that with long-term value, where, you know, the value of something that's familiar is sort of only a temporary value. And so if there's something that we actually think is fundamentally better, but maybe unfamiliar, then it might be worth the transition cost. But we only have like it's kind of like a finite budget of how many different right. things that we can do at once. And so we have to be very careful with that and sort of pick and choose the most important things.
Makes sense. Leland, this has been amazing. I know we can go on and ask you a whole bunch of questions, but we got to let you go back and experiment with those Compose APIs. If folks wanted to basically understand more about Jetpack Compose and like find out more, what are some good resources they can hit up at the moment?
Yeah, so in addition to kind of the things I mentioned, and, you know, hopefully, you know, once we reach sort of an alpha state, there will be a much healthier amount of documentation and resources. Right now, I would say where I would really point people if they want to kind of learn more and understand more is to our Slack channel. We're actually kind of using the Kotlin community Slack channel Slack community, and we have a Compose channel in there that's actually reasonably active, and several people working on Compose here at Google are participating in that channel and answering a bunch of questions. And so I think that's probably your best bet right now if you're kind of wanting to be a super early adopter and really start to dive into this stuff.
And if folks want to keep a track of like the stuff that you're working on, what is a good place to do that?
Me personally, I'm a big Twitter user, probably too much. So you can catch me on Twitter IntelliJababbel. And
That's how you say it. Damn it.
Well, actually, no, it's interesting. My blog is IntelliJable Babble. But my Twitter handle is IntelliJababbel because Twitter only allows so many characters.
That's why the cognitive complexity in my head was just getting it. Like, it just kept flip-flopping there.
This is probably not a good choice early on, but I've stuck with it. There's a lot of things that I have kind of written down that I would like to blog about, around Compose that, hopefully I'll get to, but I haven't been great. So, you know, maybe I'll take some lessons from Don.
He's the machine. He gets it done. And Don, if folks want to be inspired by your routine and how much you get out there, what's a good place to do that?
They can follow me on Twitter or Instagram at Don Felker. And Kaushik, what about you? How can they get a hold of you?
My name's also pretty long, but I managed to squeeze it into both character limits for Instagram and Twitter. It's Kaushik Gopal. So that's how folks can get a hold of my stuff. Thank you all so much for listening. Leland, again, thank you so much for waking up this early and giving us the lowdown on Jetpack Compose. It's probably one of the most exciting things for most of us Android developers. So thank you again for sharing so much about Jetpack Compose on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you all so much for listening, and we will catch you in the next episode. That's it for the show, folks. Fragmented is hosted by Don Felker and me, Kaushik Gopal. We edit and produce all the episodes here on Fragmented. Sarah the Amazing Jackson from the Spec Network helps with production assistance and wraps our final mix. Our theme and ad music is by the national recording artist Blueprint from Weightless Recordings. You can find more Fragmented episodes at fragmentedpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you in the next episode.